This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
That's it. A little clapping back there. Thank you, Rusty Simpre. It is the 21st of February. We're already 3 Sundays into the year of 2010. Is that right? 2010, 2010. 3 Sundays into February of 2010. See, I can't even keep track of where I am in the world calendar, much less in my life. A special shout out to those on Lovingston 94.7 for joining us today. Let's stick with the show instead of trying to place us in the world. Today, I think we're going to have a very interesting topic because I found I read this in the Cavalier Daily, and I immediately sent out emails trying to get the guest on the program today. We have University of Virginia Professor of Psychology Amory E. McCamey. Amory?
Hi there.
Thank you for coming in today. And with us as well is a doctoral candidate from the psychology department, Dave Sweeto.
Hi, thanks. Good morning, Rick.
All right, Dave, you got to get closer and talk louder.
Okay.
But thanks to both of you for joining us. We're going to be talking about social networking and the positive, negative, or no effect at all on what that does to, what's the proper phrase, youth, teens?
Right. Either, you know, teenagers and young adults.
Yeah,
and
young adults.
Mm-hmm. And by social networking, you know, we're talking about the online sphere, right, where it's really been hard to avoid. Everybody's just talked so much about Facebook and MySpace and these types of social networking websites, and this is something that Dave and I have been studying a lot recently, and we're pretty excited about it.
And we'll toss out the phone number in a little bit because I think there will be some questions asked about that, but let's start right away. So we have Professor of Psychology Amory E. McCamey here, and Dave Sweeto, who's a doctoral candidate, working on, I guess, have you technically just finished this study? Because 8 years. So is it finished, or are you going to go back in a little bit and follow up?
Well, it's an ongoing study. So what's neat is that the participants in the study, they were first recruited when they were preteens in 7th and 8th grade, so, you know, just 13, 14 years old. And this is a study where we, along with Professor Joe Allen and a number of other students, have been following these young people every year. They come back in every year and let us know how they're doing and how they're functioning. And so more recently, we have started to add measures of their socializing on Facebook in MySpace, given the prominence of this media. So this study is ongoing. They still continue to come in every year or so, and we're still collecting these types of measures as well.
So the study began 8 years ago. Dave, were you around then?
I wasn't around then. I just joined on about, I think, 3 years ago now, working in Dr. Joe Allen's lab, and teamed up with Professor McCamey around that time to start getting involved in that study of development and adding these measures about the online behavior. So we're both relatively newer to the project.
All right. So 8 years ago, you identify, and I think 172 students. Is that what you started with?
Yeah, that's right.
And how were the 172 students identified? I mean, I would assume that you didn't go to the downtown mall and catch the first 172 that came by. But they are all Charlottesville, Albemarle, or are they a little further out into Central Virginia? And how did you pick those?
Yeah, so the kids were recruited from the middle school in Charlottesville here. So we know Professor Allen and his team went in 8 years ago and recruited students by sending home flyers asking if they might be interested in participating in a study of, you know, adolescent development, and just kind of invited everyone who was interested in participating to join into the study. And so the nice thing about that is the group that we ended up getting for the larger study is actually pretty representative of the school and the community, the larger community as well. So we actually have a nice diversity in terms of the socioeconomic and racial ethnicity qualities of the participants as well. So it's a really nice feature of the study.
Yeah, because I would think that would be a concern, or to me, with my deep sociological background from taking my sociology major back in school, however many years ago it's been now, that making sure, because I think many people would say, well, did everybody have a computer 8 years ago or even now? I think, although I was interested to find out that something like 90% of youth and young adults today have a Facebook or MySpace.
Well,
account?
Yeah, it really is pretty common now. I mean, in our sample, it was 85% that had a Facebook or MySpace account at age 20. So what's important is that when they first entered the study at 13, Facebook and MySpace weren't even invented then. I know it's hard to believe that these websites only came into being about 2004 or so, given how it seems that everybody is using them now, everybody and their mother, in fact. But they really came into being pretty recently. So when the youth came into the study at 13, we actually did not have any measures of their online social communication. They just came. We just looked at their friendships and their relationships with their parents and their peers in the more face-to-face manners.
We are here on the Wake Up Call on Sunday, February 21st, talking about online social networking and an eight-year study with Dave Sweeto, who's working on his doctorate at the UVA Psychology Department, and Amori Yee Makami, who's a professor of psychology over at UVA. We talked about how you found all 172 students. Dave, you mentioned how you had a pretty representative group, but what were the concerns? What was the 8 years ago, what were you looking to find in an internet fashion, if at all, if Facebook and MySpace hadn't even been invented yet?
Right. That's kind of maybe one of the limitations of the larger study is just that we don't have that information when the kids first began their involvement in the study, both because the social networking websites hadn't been invented yet, but even then, it wasn't something that we had thought to kind of ask about at that time, and it's not until more recently, as all of this stuff has kind of gotten more popular and everyone has become more involved in it, that we thought it would be important to take a look at it ourselves and take a look at, you know, how the kids in the study were using these types of technologies as well and how it might impact or not impact them.
Yeah, this was just a larger study about how adolescents behave socially, broadly. So, like Dave was saying, you know, we recruited the preteens and they came in, and every year they come back and we ask them more questions about what their life is like with their friends and their family, and sometimes we bring in the friends too and have them do some tasks or, you know, some things where they have to discuss stuff with each other or solve problems with each other, and we see how that goes. You know, as they get older, they bring in their romantic partners too, and we start to look at how they're functioning in those sorts of relationships as well. So it is a broad study, just looking at how adolescents behave socially. And then it wasn't until more recently, when these websites, Facebook and MySpace, started becoming really prominent, that we thought, gosh, here's another domain where we could look at social functioning, this whole online domain that we know basically nothing about. So this was just an ideal sample to do it in.
Well, Professor Yee Makami, how do you tell me what some of the questions were that were asked 8 years ago and some of the questions that you're doing now? I mean, you mentioned tasks, et cetera, but a little more definitive from what the hell is 8 years ago? 92? I got to stick out of dates today, Sean. So tell me about 8 years ago and then now.
Mm-hmm. Well, 8 years ago, we measured a whole bunch of stuff about these young people. So one thing that we looked at is just their friendship quality, meaning that in their relationship with their best friend, were they looking like they had very supportive or positive relationships? Or did it seem like there was more antagonism or conflict or fighting in those relationships? And similarly, we also looked at things like what the parents and themselves said about their own adjustments. So some kids were having more problems with their aggressive behavior or depression. Some of them were really pretty healthy and well-adjusted, had good friends, seemed to be very well-liked by their peers in their class. And so what Dave and I were doing in the study is seeing what those kids who were very well-adjusted and had good friends, what they grew up to look like on Facebook and MySpace 8 years later. And one of the things we're most fascinated to find is that there is actually a lot of continuity, meaning that the kids who as preteens seemed really well-adjusted and had really good friends, turns out that on Facebook and MySpace, they also seem to be using those social media in very healthy ways. They had a lot of friends there, and the quality of those friendships, if you looked at the things that the friends were posting on their wall, if you're a Facebook user, you'll know what I mean. Friends leave these comments on the wall, as well as the person themselves writes these things about themselves on the wall. They also looked healthier, more supportive, more connected. They just looked like they were doing better overall socially, both online and offline.
How surprising is that? I mean, because talking with someone, a friend, about today's program and questions to ask, et cetera, doesn't the cheerleader always going to be popular? Isn't the football quarterback always going to have a lot of friends?
Well, the truth is we weren't completely sure what we would find when Dave and I started the study, because there's kind of two competing ideas that float around a lot in the media. So one is exactly what you said. You know, isn't the person who was popular as a preteen always just going to be popular and well-liked and doing well? So that was one idea, which is more what we found. But there's this whole other idea out there, right, that the Internet is just a refuge for the young people who are socially inept. So the ones that can't find friends face-to-face, they turn to the Internet to spend all their time trying to make friends there. And that these Internet relationships are really superficial with people that they don't know very well, and so ultimately the quality of those relationships just aren't the same as what you can get face-to-face. So because of that competing idea, too, we weren't sure if we were going to find that it was the most poorly adjusted kids using Facebook and MySpace and using them poorly, or if it was, in fact, more like what we did find, that it was the best adjusted kids who were using this social media and using it well in similar ways as they did face to face.
We're talking about social networking, online social networking, and a study done by Professor Amori Yimikami at the psychology department here at UVA, as well as Dave Sweeto working on his doctoral degree. Just a question. Psychology, anthropology, psychology, because I guess when I first started reading the Kevlar Daily article, I thought, oh, this must be a sociology study. Oh, wait, no, it's not. Tell me what the difference is, and is there any difference between how this would be performed in other departments?
You know, I'm not entirely sure about that. I think from what I do know, sociology studies might tend to be a little bit more broad in their scope and sometimes might not be able to kind of get at the richness of the interactions and the friendships and the qualities of the teens that I think we were able to get at in our study by kind of assessing, you know, a fairly large sample of kids, but at the same time we were able to kind of study them intensely and learn a lot about them that you might not be able to learn in a broader sociological study or a study. You know, there's a lot of statistics out there about Internet use that use these large representative national samples, but unfortunately when you're doing studies like that, you kind of can't ask as many questions or you can't get as in-depth in smaller studies, which we think is kind of a real strength of our approach here.
A lot of people would say whether you use Facebook regularly or MySpace or you don't, is that for some people the goal is just to find as many friends as you can. Being connected through the number of comments that are made on your wall or the number of friends that are listed along the side, does that really say how connected that you are? So tell me what you use to determine how connected someone was, and then therefore I what I'm hearing is expanded as to be well adjusted in a social manner.
Right. That's definitely a concern, because what we found in our study actually is that the average number of friends that people reported, well, not even reported, but, you know, we actually went on their websites and were able to look at how many friends that they had in their networks.
You got that permission, right, by becoming a friend of theirs?
That's right. We either ask them for permission to become their friends online, or sometimes the pages were just available in the public domain, which we were able to then just look at that way. And so, right, we could actually go onto their pages and, as Professor Makami was talking about, look at the kinds of comments they were receiving from their friends, but also, right, just look at the sheer number of friends they had on their page. And the average number of friends, I believe, was something like 300 for the participants that we looked at. So you can wonder how many of these friends are people actually talking to, you know, how many do they actually even know in person, and what does that mean?
Right, that you could identify when you ran into them somewhere.
Right, right. A lot of times people, you know, you hear anecdotally that people don't even know the people that they're friending, but they become part of their network anyway. And so that's one of the questions we kind of had is, you know, what does that mean, in terms of kids' adjustment? But right. So what we kind of thought was more important perhaps was to look at the quality of the relationships. But to answer your question in terms of connection, we did that by looking at the comments that people left on the participants' MySpace or Facebook page and looked at, you know, do they talk about actually meeting up in person? Do they talk about, you know, let's get together on Friday night, or it was great seeing you yesterday, and kind of use that as a measure of how connected kids were to the friends that they had on these websites.
What's interesting to me is that the participants who were best adjusted at age 13, not only did they have more friends, just in terms of a sheer number of friends at 20 on Facebook and MySpace, but also they had a greater proportion of connected friends, as indicated by what Dave was saying in the type of comments where people were talking about meeting up in person.
We are talking about social networking, a study recently, I guess not finished, but reached the 8-year stage with Dave Sweeto, who's working on his doctorate degree at UVA's psychology department, and Professor Amori Yi Makami, who is an assistant professor of psychology. 1117 on the Wake Up Call. Dial up, ask your question, make your comment. 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is the toll-free number. Folks, an anonymous caller, asks if you tracked any cell phone usage among the youth, and that had anything, any play in networking.
You know, we didn't, and that's something that we've just started talking about in our research group is, you know, we've broadened into online behavior, but we realize we're probably also still kind of missing some other aspects of technology that have really become more popular. And cell phone use and texting is one thing that we are considering looking at in the future, but we don't have that right now, unfortunately.
All right, dial up with your question or comment as well. You can also send us an instant message talking about technology, WNRN Studio, the AOL Instant Message Network, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. I'd like to have a definition for online behavior, quality online behavior, or whatever the proper term that I should be using is, well-adjusted online behavior. Describe that to me so that I can figure out whether what my thoughts on that are fit into the studies.
Well, I think that in the way that we were assessing it in this study, at least, it's probably not an exhaustive assessment. It would probably be youth who seem to be interacting online in ways that where the interactions are supportive and friendly, as opposed to antagonistic or critical or hostile or aggressive. It would also be interactions with people who they seem to have deep or at least not superficial relationships with. So it's not something where they just, you know, have a really casual or superficial comment, but these are often interactions online with people who they also see in face-to-face relationships, who are very meaningful to them, who they talk with on the phone, people who they feel really get them and know them. So it'd be that type of interaction. And it would probably also be these interactions that are, I would say appropriate in the type of quantity. So what would be appropriate would be for a young person would be having these sorts of peer interactions, a moderate amount, but not either too little or too much, because you could really just spend all day on this and it could take up your whole life. Or on the other hand, you could just be very isolated and not have any interactions at all. So I guess that's what I think of when I think about the most healthy ways that these young people are using these websites.
Is there an over under number for number of peers or friends on your page, or friends that you have more deep relationships with?
Yeah, that's kind of hard to say, because obviously it's going to be a little bit different for everybody, and also some people are just using online media more than other people. They just might have, for instance, more access to computers than others, or a faster internet connection. So I'd be hesitant to say a certain number, but I guess it's more I'd like just to get across maybe more the feeling that the young people who I think are using it well, they are, they're getting positive interactions out of these online experiences that are supportive, and they're using it to further and deepen these friendships that they also have in face-to-face or phone or other sorts of contacts.
All right, 11:21 here on the Wake Up Call. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny today, highs in the low 50s, just upper 40s over in the valley. Mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain after midnight tonight, in the mid-30s. And you know what? Possible freezing rain over in the valley. And then cloudy with rain tomorrow morning. Again, some freezing rain in the morning in the valley. Expected highs 43 to 48, and right now it's a pretty nice day out there. 39 in the valley, 45 in Lynchburg, 56 in Richmond, 46 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's give a shout out to Escafé for supporting us today. You can find them on the downtown mall across from the Omni and the Ice Park. They now serve lunch from 11:30 till 2:30, Tuesday through Saturday. Salads and soba noodles, house greens, and sandwiches like the curried turkey salad or the tofu souvlaki, as well as lunch entrees including pan-seared tuna cakes and vegetable lasagna. That's Escafé on Charlottesville's downtown mall. Online, escafé.com. And I need to tell you about WHTJ, their Charlottesville's local PBS TV station. You can find them on channel 41.2, cable 265, and dish 41 here in Charlottesville. WHTJ checks out a progressive arts initiative at a Charlottesville music gallery and then visits with a UVA surgeon and researcher with a new approach to curing cancer. Terry Allard hosts Charlottesville Inside Out. You can find them Thursday night, 8:30. That's WHTJ, Charlottesville's PBS, digital 41.2, standard cable 7, or digital cable 265 in Charlottesville, and more online at ideastation.org. All right, 979-0919 with your question or comment, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Guest today, Professor Amori Yee Mikami, from the UVA Psychology Department, and Dave Sweeto, who is a graduate student working on his doctorate degree, also participating in the study about internet social networking and the youth group starting at age 13 to 14 and being recently revisited at age 20 or so. One of the things you talk about, Dave, I think you mentioned being able to go to the website, the MySpace page, the Facebook page, and some of them people let you on to be a friend so you could look, and others the page was a public page. And privacy has been a big concern on Facebook and just throughout the internet area as well. Was there any difference between those who had their page fully public versus those who had some privacy pages?
You know, that's a good question, and we actually did not take a look at that in terms of whether their pages were public or private, and so that would be a really interesting thing for us to look at. And you're right, there are a lot of concerns in terms of public versus private pages, and that comes a lot in terms of employers and employers now looking often at people's pages. And if they're public, they obviously have easy access to that. But I'm also aware, but this is kind of more anecdotally, of you know, employers using their employees who have connections to potential hirees to look at their pages and try to get a sense of whether or not there's anything alarming, I guess, on those pages. And so it's certainly a relevant question, especially as these teenagers are approaching kind of especially those who are maybe in college and are trying to hit the job market right now.
We mentioned technology, and one of the things that I've always found is that there seems to be sort of technology is a major part in defining generations. You know, if you go through sort of in a calendar fashion, and here I go back to that, but the last year of the baby boomers is 1963 or 64, and so they... However this definition is made, it's almost by some sort of bell curve. But I've always found that my sort of definition was, if you can remember when President Kennedy was shot, then you fall in this age group, but otherwise you fall in this age group. If you can have visual memories of, you know, I can remember my dad sitting me down to watch the lunar landing, so I fall into an age group that others do not. But technologically... If you don't have a Facebook page or you barely use your Facebook page, you're much more separated than this age group here. If you only ever use your remote control to change the channel on your TV, then you fall here. So have you found that there is some sort of break between the parents and the kids because of this? Because I would assume that you had to talk to the parents at least in some minor way.
Well, there's definitely a generation gap in terms of the use of online social media like Facebook and MySpace. It's interesting because, you know, young people are just so much, in general, they're just so much more online than older adults. But when you also start to look at what the differences between what they're doing online, that's where the generation divide, I think, increases more.
Ooh, what's that?
Well, like, for instance, even among the online users of teenagers and older adults, what the teenagers are doing online is they're using the internet to keep in contact with their friends, make new friends, and basically socialize. What the adults are using the internet for is to do things like look up plane reservations, compare health insurance plans, or otherwise just do research on some sort of topic, or do like online banking, for example. So this whole use of the internet to socialize is very much predominated by the young people, and I think that's one reason why they flocked so much to online social media sites like Facebook and MySpace.
And one of the things is that what you found, if I'm correct, now that we're 28 minutes into the program with Professor Amori E. McCamey from UVA Psychology Department and Dave Sweeto, a doctoral candidate working on the study as well, is that there wasn't anything for the parents to worry about, that they're really the internet social networking wasn't, and again, we're defining it in a small manner, I guess, but there wasn't anything for the parent to worry about.
Well, the thing is that obviously every teenager is doing something slightly different, but so it's not that you can make an entirely blanket statement that no parent should worry or all parents should worry, for instance. But I do think that these results may help to allay some parents' fears because of the fact that, you know, it seemed in our sample that if the teenagers were otherwise well adjusted, you know, very, very few behavior problems, not depressed, not aggressive, doing well otherwise, had good friends, good quality relationships, were pretty well liked, then those were the young people that seemed to be using, on average, Facebook and MySpace and similar healthy ways to keep in contact with the friends that they already knew, and that the quality of these interactions online on Facebook and MySpace seemed, again, to be quite positive. So in that sense, I think that it can allay some parents' fears that, you know, if their child is doing well otherwise, it's not necessarily just inherently a bad thing that their child is spending so much time on these online media. So I think, you know, I think some parents can probably feel better about that. But it obviously it's different for every teenager. And I think the take-home message is that I would probably just encourage parents to try and be involved in their teenager's social world and understand who their teenagers hang out with and what their teenager is doing both online and offline to just get a better impression of what's going on.
Does that carry over to the break between age groups? For the 20-year-old, who you've had in your program from since they were 12, 13, 14 years old. So they have a well-adjusted social life at the young age, and then 8 years later they seem to have a seemingly still well-adjusted social life. But the social life is amongst their peers. I've heard that word several times in this within the half hour. Does that still work when they go to meet the 50-year-old who's interviewing them for their job? Does that mean that they can have a good relationship with their parents or their grandparents or someone else who doesn't fall into the same age bracket and understanding of what they're doing and how often they're doing it?
Right. It's sounding to me like you're wondering if somehow these individuals who are so wrapped up in this technology might lose touch in some way. Perhaps.
You can go to the grocery store or anywhere, and the child who is forced to follow their parent to wherever they are in a public venue is walking along texting the entire time. They don't even have to be out. You can be sitting at home, and the child is texting the entire time. The youth is texting the entire time. And I think for many people, they would say, goodness, how wrapped up are they that they can't even lift their eyes and pay attention to where they are, whether it's at home, whether it's at the grocery store, wherever they might be.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and I think it's something that we could potentially even follow forward in our study now, just to see how this involvement might impact future relationships of these youth. And one of the things that I am interested in doing is actually going, at least for now, is to go backwards the other way. You know, you were right. You said we've talked a lot about how peer relationships might be involved in this kind of social adjustment, but I am also interested in exploring the role of family relationships in this adjustment as well, to see what kind of influences that even early family relationships might have on whether or not youth get involved in this type of technology and what kind of effects on their adjustment that it might have too, because I think that's also a really important context, as you're mentioning.
Here's a question that's come across. Do different social sites have any different effects? So, because some are private, correct? Facebook, and then there's a handful of different private ones. Have you found anything out in that way, or kept track of which internet social sites being used?
Well, we only did the study actually looking at Facebook and MySpace, and we do recognize that a number of the youth were on other sorts of social networking pages, but the way that those pages were set up were just too different from Facebook and MySpace for us to be able to draw any sort of similarities in terms of having a similar coding scheme. So it's true that, you know, we don't particularly know. One thing that we have just speculated about, although again we don't know this yet, is we think that the public nature of Facebook and MySpace, in the sense that people are really encouraged to put their real name up, and you know, it's very non-anonymous. You know, most of the time, you know, you leave a post on someone's wall, or you do something to somebody, but it says it's from you, and everybody can see that. You know, we think that this might encourage, in some ways, the young adults to behave online in similar ways as they behave face to face. database, but we don't know how this would carry over to maybe more anonymous online interactions.
11:34 here on the Wake Up Call with Professor Amori E. McCamey and doctoral candidate Dave Sweeto from UVA's Psychology Department as we talk about internet social networking with some youth, an eight-year ongoing study. Call up 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, or use your social media and send us an internet message, WNRN Studio at the AOL site. Let me thank Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to be online today. Blue Ridge Graphics, Mead Avenue at East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom T-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. We've talked about, I guess, normal behavior for the folks in the study and the fact that current behavior, if you're using the internet social sites properly, I guess, I don't even know if that's the right word to use, but for many people who, I'll say this, for an older crowd, much of that is very egotistical. Who cares about all the things that are posted on the wall? The Twitter site, which I guess didn't fall into this study, why do you feel the need to tell somebody that you are driving, you know, you're sitting passenger in the seat while someone drives you across? I read this just yesterday from a friend on their site. Oh, the view across the Veronzo Bridge is beautiful. And just so many things like that about allowing people to be up to date on your personal life just so openly and so often. Is that another break in the generation gap, or is there some more psychological term there?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good point, and I'm not entirely sure, and so I'm kind of speculating on this as you're asking about it. But part of what kind of is striking me as you're asking this question is, right, why put this out there? Is it to be vain? Is it to be egotistical? Or is it perhaps maybe on some level kind of a bid to be connected to other people and hope that someone is going to see what you're putting out there and kind of resonate with it in some way or react to it in some way that garners some kind of response? And is it really kind of another way potentially for people to just kind of feel connected, it's different from necessarily directly contacting someone else, but maybe there is kind of some aspect of connecting to that type of behavior too.
Is that the way that, or is that a way that people feel connected in this modern culture, is to participate in putting up regular little tidbits about your daily life?
Well, I think it's hard for adults or people in a different generation, really, I'd say, to understand this, because I do think that it does. I mean, I definitely get why some people feel like this seems egotistical. But again, like Dave was saying, I'm not sure if it is egotistical as much as it's just another way to communicate and feel connected. And it's a way that if everybody in your social group is doing that, then it doesn't become egotistical to do that. It just becomes a way to pitch in and communicate. So, for example, you know, I think that there's plenty of older adults or middle-aged adults who have very tight-knit friend groups where they meet every week to play bridge, or they, you know, have periodic family vacations where their, you know, multiple families go congregate down at Nag's Head or Myrtle Beach, and they share a house for a week, and everybody's in all their other stuff, all everybody's stuff, and they're showering all the kids together after they come back from the water. And this is, you know, this is just what that social group does. So I think that sometimes for teenagers, similarly, displaying information about themselves to their social network that's online, while it may seem like, oh, you know, where are these people's privacy, and it's so egotistical to adults, it's just a way that is considered normal in that context of being a teenager and their friend group to share information and to connect with each other.
11:39 here on the Wake Up Call. Professor Amori Yimikami and doctoral candidate Dave Sweeto from the psychology department at UVA as we talk about an ongoing study about a youth group and internet social networking.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, and local man has two films out, one he directed and one in which he stars, heading to the Austin, Texas South by Southwest Film Festival next month. Why does eBay not allow a Crozet man to continue selling old issues of High Times magazine? And who exactly is local teacher John Hunter? The Hook puts him on the hot seat. The Hook, back by popular demand. And let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports. They remind you that winter in Virginia is cold and wet, duh, and doesn't end till late March. But you can keep yourself warm and dry by visiting Blue Ridge Mountain Sports to see their selection of Gore-Tex outerwear and footwear, as well as smart wool socks, hats, and gloves. That's Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville. You can find them at Wintergreen as well, in the Chesterfield Town Center, and West Broad Street in the Richmond area. Online, brms.com. And lots of radio stations and other music sources out there, but only one that brings you the Wake Up Call. And the only reason we can do this is because of listeners like Mike Jamerson, Kathy Hinchy, and my mom, all who supported us in the fall fund drive. Also because of program underwriters like the ones you hear from this hour, as well as Price Hyundai Isuzu and Integral Yoga. So stay tuned and tell a friend about the Wake Up Call and other programming you enjoy on WNRN. And be sure to support us in the next fund drive coming up in the spring. All right, back in action with Dave Sweeto and Amori Yimikami. Did you talk to the families at all, either in the beginning or at the end? Because I would wonder if the family that paid more attention to what their child was doing online might have a role in the outcome, or at least 8 years later.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we're actually working on now is looking at the role of the family, especially as you're saying at the beginning of the study, and what kind of effect that those kinds of relationships might have had on youth's later online behavior. And right, unfortunately, we don't have kind of direct measures of how well parents were monitoring online behavior, but we do have other measures that kind of get at other qualities of adjustment in terms of how well parents are communicating with their kids and whether they're having more positive or negative relationships with them at that age. And we do think that that might sort of set the tone for whether or not youth are more or less likely to sort of be pushed online and to use the online social networking pages in certain ways. And that's something that we're working on right now.
Because I think, you know, one of the things that that stood out to me is if you're, and I'll make this quite simple, if you're normal at 12, you're normal at 20, and if you're having problems at 12, you're probably having problems at 20. How much of that is related to the individual or the social, doesn't seem the right word, but the family area that they're in at both visitation times? Do we have any idea of that?
Well, one of the things that we have been thinking about is, you know, if kids are having poor relationships with their parents early on and learning maybe that, you know, communicating with people isn't much fun because they're getting kind of in more negative interactions with their parents, might that somehow lead them to feel like they need to express themselves in other ways and in other contexts? And so we're wondering if kids who are experiencing more negativity within their family relationships early on, if they might perhaps even be more likely to feel like they can better express themselves online. And then the question is, if that could be true in any way, is are they going to be able to express themselves in positive ways online, or is that negativity perhaps going to carry over from the early family relationships.
Did you track whether or not the family had any house rules for using the computer, the internet, at either age?
We didn't, unfortunately. So, you know, at the same time, when we followed up at age 20, most of these kids are out of the house at this point. And so at least at the follow-up time point, I wouldn't be so certain that there necessarily are rules at that time. But early on, we don't know, and that's a good question.
I think it must be really difficult for parents who, you know, you have a young or middle teenager, and you realize that things may not be going so well for your teenager at school, with friends. These parents, they're very worried about their teens, but if you have a poor relationship, if it seems like every single time you try and talk to your teen about this, all that leads to is fighting, or the teen not wanting to talk to you back, that puts parents in a very, very tough position. It just, I think it worries parents a lot. It's a hard thing to get out of that probably won't change overnight, but I guess, you know, I would advise parents to just try to take an interest in what your teenager is doing socially, both online and offline, without being really pushy. So try to approach it from more of a, I just want to find out more about you, as opposed, if the teenager feels less like you're going to criticize them for what they tell you. And then, you try and do things like that, and do fun things with your teenager that both of you will enjoy together, that is, you know, not likely to cause an argument about behavior problems, but you guys can just spend some time doing something together that you both like. Then these sorts of things may help to build a relationship where you can get in more and, you know, talk more, and then find out more about what's going on in the online sphere for your teen.
Dave, I think you mentioned at the start when we talked about how the 172 students were selected, that a flyer went home through the school system, mm-hmm. and they signed up on their own, correct?
Right.
Were there any learning disabled kids, autistic children? Because there's been the argument made, correct or not, and you may have better information than I have, that the internet is much more socially available to them, to learning disabled and autistic style children.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that Professor McCamey, I think, was mentioning earlier about kind of the two competing ideas in terms of who's going to be using the internet. And that certainly, as you're saying, has been one of them, is that, you know, kids who might have communication problems in some form or another, or social problems of one form or another, might they be more likely, or might it be easier for them to communicate with other people online? And in terms of our study, we didn't have anyone. We didn't look at specific things such as learning disabilities, I can't say we don't have anyone in the study who is autistic, but we do have. And Professor McCamey looked at some of this in the study in terms of just those individual characteristics that might, you know, push someone to potentially go online, such as kids who are more depressed, and actually found kind of the opposite, that kids who are more depressed are less likely to be using these social networking pages. But it also kind of begs the question, could they be using other more anonymous technologies, like Professor McCamey was saying earlier, too?
Professor, do you have any things that cannot be shown through the study, but things that you have a thought process about, or things that you did find but just not enough information to be included,
right,
in a more definitive way?
Right. Well, like Dave was saying, we do wonder if the youth who had very serious behavior problems or things like autism, for example, none of whom were in our study, if they might not be using the internet a lot, but just not necessarily using Facebook or MySpace. They might be turning to internet interactions that are more anonymous, or turning to online gaming, for example. But we just think that Facebook and MySpace, because it's so public and, you know, everybody knows who you are, and because it's so typical that young people are using it, that's why we may have found such parallels, that the best adjusted kids were the ones that were most likely to be using Facebook and MySpace. And
because
them
well. They're the typical media,
right,
that you're going to get the more typical.
Right,
And because of that, the larger percentage being typical. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how you define average person.
I think for teenagers now, you know, Facebook and MySpace, it's just like going to the mall with a whole group of your friends, going to a house party at someone's house, going to a slumber party.
And they're
party,
not hanging out in my way.
calling somebody on the phone. Because Facebook and MySpace are just such a typical way to communicate like those other methods, you get, you know, like I said, the best adjusted kids socializing a lot, both on Facebook and MySpace and in those other ways. But this might not be true for things like online gaming or other types of internet activities that are less common, and therefore perhaps people with learning disabilities or autism might be more drawn to those types of media.
11:50 here on the Wake Up Call. Professor Amori E. Mikami, associate professor from, assistant professor. What's the difference?
usually you're an assistant professor for about 6 or 7 years, and then you go up for promotion, which sometimes comes with tenure, and then the associate would be the next step. So I'm not there yet.
All right. Well, good luck. Keep going. Hopefully the study will push you along and people will recognize. And you're welcome to include me as a reference for being on the show for the hour.
I sure will. Thank you, Rick.
Professor Amori E. Mikami from the psych department at UVA, and Dave Sweeto working on his doctorate degree, as we're talking about internet social networking and how that fits into the current youth group, an 8-year ongoing study. I don't know that this falls into things that you've discovered from the study, but people, and one of the concerns for parents is always the negative effect of what they're doing. And people always say that Facebook and similar sites, or just being online so often, kind of reduces attention span, and it makes your kids want instant gratification because you can immediately send out the email and get a reply, texting, etc. Did you find anything like that? Have you included anything like that in part of the ongoing study or what you've already done?
Well, I don't think this is something that our data can speak to. Just in terms of speculation, of course, that isn't backed by the research. I think it probably is true that if you're used to emailing, it's the same with email, though. It's not just Facebook. But, if you're used to emailing a lot and getting a quick answer as opposed to having to write a letter and wait for somebody to respond to you, or just similarly, you probably do expect things to happen sooner, but I'm not so sure that that's a sign of impatience or if that's such a bad thing. I mean, maybe that's just a benefit of what has happened with technology. I mean, I think about when telephones were created, there was a lot of the similar hullabaloo that we get now with the internet. People were saying, it's going to, relationships are going to get very superficial because everybody's just going to call each other as opposed to see each other face to face.
Or wait for their Pony Express mail to get there.
Yeah, and similarly, everybody's going to get impatient and have a very short attention span because you can just pick up the phone and call and get an answer as opposed to, again, waiting for the Pony Express or whatever equivalent. And, now we've, fast forward to the current time, and phones are just accepted, and we're having the same argument about internet.
The argument is made that spelling is just ruined by email. And not even because you use iconic figures or type phonetically, but just because people don't capitalize, there's poor grammar, et cetera. Any arguments? And I realize this isn't part of the study. We're sort of stepping sideways here. But I think that would be part of the argument as to why relationships, because you have short attention spans, et cetera, similar argument?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, there is a distinction between what you might spell or the grammar you'd use online versus, say, when you were trying to write a formal paper or a resume or a job cover letter. And I do think that, for the majority of young people, they do know the difference. Now, some people don't, but they probably have other problems that, accounts for the fact that they can't tell the difference between how you should write on an email to your friend versus how you should write in, a formal report for your job, for instance. They're probably the similar type of people that don't understand the difference of how to dress when you're with your friends versus how to dress when you're on a job interview. So, I think that, as long as parents and teachers are really being sure to talk to their teenagers about the differences in different situations, I think it is probably, that's just probably the important thing to do.
Well, and one more sort of part of this before we step back into the topic is that a lot of, you know, when I was doing my homework for the program, and again, it's so hard with the internet because it only takes one person, you know, telling false truths for it to be exploded into, you know, 5,000 websites or links to their particular website, is that parents and teachers say that they have very difficult times at talking to the student face-to-face because they're so used to their communication going on through the computer screen. Did you, you know, discover any of that, or have you experienced any problem? Because, Professor, you, I would think, would have almost some similar personal relationships in teaching to that age group now.
Right, that's right. I mean, you know, of course, the majority of, you know, I have so many undergraduate students who are in the 18 to 22-year-old demographic. Again, this isn't something that was dealt with in our study, but just in terms of my personal experience and speculation, I just think that for generations and generations, there's been difficulty with adults connecting with young people. There's been hordes of teachers who try to talk to their students, and even if their students aren't texting or haven't even had a computer, they're staring at their fingernails, making surly expressions, and thinking about how they really wish they were at the mall with their friends instead of stuck here with this old teacher. So I don't think that the internet has necessarily changed any of that, you know, necessarily. I mean, in terms of me with my own teaching, I personally find that it's been really helpful for me actually to connect with the students by using instant messaging. So, for example, you know, I have office hours, and you know, the traditional thing is you have office hours, and before a test, you make the student come in to see you at your office hours face to face and say, you know, I don't understand this question, then you explain it to them. And some students will do that, and it's helpful to do it face to face sometimes, but I think it cuts out a lot of the students who are either too intimidated to go there, or that just happens to be at an hour or a time that's not convenient for when they study, because most of them study, you know, late at night, the night before, and most professors aren't sitting in their office at that time, or at least I'm not. So what I found that helpful to do is, in addition to those face-to-face office hours, I have an online office hour or two using instant messaging right before the test, and I very often, you know, I'm getting like 40-50% of my class contacting me there, you know, so that's like 60 or 70 students contacting me online in these online office hours, whereas in a face-to-face office hour, I might get 3 people maximum, you know, 3 out of a class of 150 coming in. So I think it's actually helped my communication.
11:57 on the wake-up call, finishing up our hour with Professor Amori Iyemakami and doctoral candidate Dave Sweeto from UVA's Psychology Department. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Professor and Dave, what's next? I mean, you've identified it as an ongoing study, and the current group is only going to get older and older and older, and at some point I would think there's going to be a technology break between them and the next group.
Yeah, well, what's next from my perspective is, now that we've been able to collect some of this online information for the past few years now, and because we are continuing to follow them in the future, we can start looking at how these technologies are actually going to impact their future adjustment. So with the study that Professor Makami was doing, she was able to predict from, you know, early relationships to future online behavior. And now I think one of the things we're interested in is looking at how online behavior itself kind of predicts future in-person adjustment, as you were sort of alluding to, in terms of, you know, does it, you know, somehow lead to individuals being less able to communicate face-to-face or better able, or kind of, I mean, it's sort of an open question at this point, is how does this technology affect people going forward?
You know, we've noticed that some young adults, they have great face-to-face relationships and also great online relationships like we were talking about, but then there's also some who, of course, have better online relationships than face-to-face relationships, or vice versa. And so we're just really interested in seeing how that would unfold over the years, or the implications on their future adjustment. Ultimately, you know, this technology changes really fast. We are just going to work to stay on top of it.
Well, I'm fascinated by it, and I hope at some point we can have you back on in the future to talk more about it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much for coming in. Our man, Drew Thompson, up next with Les Temps Purdue.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.